1 Corinthians chapter 12. 2 weeks ago, I started on this sermon, and I spent the entire time on an introduction to it. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the different gifts of the Spirit and why Romans and 1 Corinthians, when it talks about the gifts of the Spirit, have kind of completely different things mentioned there. What we see in Corinthians is the particular gifts of the Spirit tend to be lean more towards the supernatural side, while the gifts of the Spirit that we see in Romans tend to be more like what we would consider to be natural abilities, maybe supercharged natural abilities, but nevertheless natural. Like, for example, teaching is listed as one of the gifts in Romans, and, you know, I might actually have that gift, if I have any, of teaching. But the supernatural gifts we see had a particular role, and they were distributed through the hands of the apostles. So I don't want to go and repeat all that, but the reason I got into that last time was because as we go through this passage in 1 Corinthians 12, and it talks about these gifts, I want you to know that even though there are some of these things have their usefulness, let's put it that way, their usefulness was ended at the time that the apostles' ministry was over, the principles that are behind all of that's taught in this chapter are still relevant for us today. All right? The principles behind it, and that is the fact that we all have different gifts from God. And whatever those gifts are, whether they're supernatural or not supernatural, whatever they are, they have a purpose. And we need to understand what that purpose is. So that's what we're going to that's what we're trying to do now. All right, let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 1. Now, concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be ignorant. You know that you were Gentiles carried away to these dumb idols. However, you were led. Therefore, I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God calls Jesus accursed, and no one can say that Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. Whenever you see the word therefore, what does it mean? Yeah, I've heard that. Anybody ever hear a preacher say that? Whenever you see the word therefore, you should ask, what is it there for? You've heard that before, right? It's not a bad slogan. It's kind of overused, but it's not a bad slogan. But what does it imply? What is it? What, you see the word therefore, what does it imply? It's all right. It's drawing a conclusion based on what came before it, right? It's going to point to a conclusion based on what before it. So what it means is that verse 3, whatever verse 3 is teaching, is there because of verse 2, right? You agree with that? Now, he says, look at verse 1. Concerning spiritual gifts, I don't want you to be ignorant. All right, so Paul's telling us his purpose now. He doesn't want us to be ignorant about spiritual gifts. Then he says, he points to the history of the people that he's writing to. What was their history? What did they used to be? Pagans. Pagans are people who worshiped idols. You know that you were Gentiles carried away to these dumb... Now, why? Tell me something. Why does he call them dumb idols? You know, every word is important in the Bible. All right? Every word has meaning. Why does he call them dumb idols? They couldn't speak. The word dumb means they couldn't speak. But why does he call them idols that can't speak? He could give his shot. He could right off the top of his head. You got to catch up there, Steve.
God was basically saying, you know, let's take all your pagan idols and let's hear what they have to say.
Yeah, you're right.
Let's see them do wonders.
Yeah, that's right. Isaiah, particularly. In Isaiah, in his prophecies, God is speaking through Isaiah the prophet, and he essentially mocks the pagan gods. Mocks them. Look, they're made out of wood. They can't speak. They can't even stand. In fact, you got to nail them down so they don't tip over. You know, and you've got all these prophets talking about the true God and what he has done and how he has revealed himself in so many ways. And the pagan gods, look, hello, nobody's home. You know, that's essentially what they're doing. It's sort of a, it was sort of a mockery of the pagan religions. All right. And so Paul, he kind of carries that into his comments here. He says that the idols that the Gentiles used to worship are dumb. They can't speak. Now, why does he say that in this context? He says it because in this context, he's talking about spiritual gifts and that the true God does something in contrast to the pagan gods who can't speak. And what is that? He speaks. All right? The true God speaks. And with regard to some of these gifts, they are speaking gifts. That is, God gave, the Holy Spirit in the early church gave certain men words to come forth from their mouth. That was the words of God. That's what prophecy was the words of God. And when they spoke in tongues, that is, in languages that were foreign to them, that is, God gave someone the ability to speak his words in a different language than they knew themselves, for the benefit of somebody else who spoke that language. And it was a miracle because that person had never learned that language. How could they speak something in a language they had never heard? And that was a gift that God used in the early church as well. All right. A lot of these gifts had to do with God speaking by the Spirit through individual people, in contrast to the dumb idols who couldn't say anything. All right. So he's implying here that what was going on with these gifts is something supernatural, right? All right, look at the next verse. Oh, before we go there, notice the words carried away in verse 2. He said, you were Gentiles carried away to these dumb idols, however you were led. Now, how were they led to worship idols? Pagans, how were they led? The word led means to be, it's exactly what it means in English. You lead sheep, right? Isn't that right? What does it mean? You get them to follow you to someplace. The Gentiles were led or coerced, or they were, someone caused them to go to these idols and worship the idols. Who was that? Go ahead, Kathy.
The emperor?
Huh?
The emperor, the leader?
No, I was thinking more of along the lines of the devil and demons.
Same.
All right. Again, if you go back a couple chapters, I pointed this out before, but just flip back a page to chapter 10, verse 19, when he says, what am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything? Rather, the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You know why? Because demons were behind every pagan religion. Demons were the ones that led people and caused people to worship idols. And when people were sacrificing to an imaginary God that they thought that this idol was, in reality, they were sacrificing to the ones that were leading them to worship false idols, which were the demons, because they were the ones behind this kind of activity. All right? So they were led to worship idols by demons. Can demons do things that are supernatural? When I say supernatural, I mean things that don't occur naturally. Sure they can. They can. Some things, with limitations, of course, but demons can do certain things. I mean, there's examples of it in the Gospels. Didn't demons enter into a herd of swine and cause them to all commit suicide and run down into a steep place into the sea and all drown, according to the Gospel of Luke? Yeah, demons did that. Is that natural? No. That's not natural. For a bunch of pigs to commit suicide is not natural. Okay? So demons can do things that are not natural. Can God do things that are not natural?
Of course.
Okay, now, anytime we start dealing with things that are supernatural, there's a danger. Isn't that right? What is the danger?
Danger is some things are of God, some things are of the devil.
Now, does God pretend to be a demon?
No.
Does the Holy Spirit ever pretend to be a demon so he can deceive you?
No.
Do demons ever pretend to be the Holy Spirit so that they can deceive you?
Yes.
Oh, because one of these, God is not a deceiver, but the father of lies is a deceiver. Isn't that right? Now, the Apostle Paul, when he's going to start talking about spiritual gifts and supernatural things, he wants to warn them because they came from a background where some supernatural things actually occurred in their pagan rituals, demon possessions, things like that. All right? Things that appear to be, might seem actually similar to some of the things that God does, because what does Satan always try to do? Exactly. Satan tries to mimic God. Satan wants to be God. God is worshipped, so Satan wants to be worshipped. Demons want to be worshipped. They want to deceive you, okay? There's always a danger whenever we're talking about anything supernatural. There's always a danger of the counterfeiter trying to bring in something fake and deceive God's people, because what does he actually ultimately want to do? Turn us away from the worship of the one true God to the worship of himself and his demons. That's what he wants to do. I mean, this whole story in Revelation is about that, isn't it? The Antichrist and all that, it's all about worshiping the beast, and you know, and Satan gives his power to the beast and all that stuff. Yes.
Have you heard the Screw Tape Letters by C.S. Lewis?
Yes.
It takes a personal face in that story of how it follows like demons trying to deceive Christians,
mm-hmm.
and they call God the enemy in the story. That shows how they try to deceive people and culture. It's really interesting to take on like that idea of masquerading.
And that's what Gnosticism did as well. Gnosticism flipped the gospel completely upside down. It made God into the devil and the devil into God. You know, and a lot of paganism does that as well. All right. Now, so what Paul is talking about in verse 2, he's talking about the fact that they used to be worshiping idols. These were dumb idols, but yet he had just said that if they sacrifice things to idols, they're actually sacrificing to demons. So there is something behind that. There is a supernatural power in paganism there as well. So then he says in verse 3, therefore, drawing a conclusion, he says, therefore, I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God, and when he says that, he's talking about the exercise of what appear to be supernatural gifts. That is speaking type gifts, prophecy, speaking in tongues, a word of knowledge, things like that. All right. So he gives them a test, a criteria whereby they can test any supposed prophecy or manifestation that has words. They can test it to see whether it is from God or not from God. And what is the test that he says here? Therefore, I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God, that is not just speaking from themselves, but speaking in this supernatural way, calls Jesus accursed. And no one can say that Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. Now, it doesn't mean a person can't say that. It means someone speaking under a supernatural influence, that the words are not coming from them, they're coming from some other source. That if that's the case, if they're proclaiming that Jesus is Lord, the Holy Spirit is the source, the supernatural source behind them. But if they are in any way implying that Jesus is not Lord or that Jesus is accursed in any way, that it's a demonic spirit that's behind it. All right, that's what he says. So this is a test that the Apostle Paul gives here. Now, can you think of another passage in the Bible, in the New Testament, that gives a similar test for what the source of the spiritual manifestation is? I see Stephen nodding his head back there. I don't think it's because he's in back pain.
No.
Okay, what is it, Steve? Okay, let's look at that. 1 John chapter 4. Excuse me. 1 John 4, verse 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. Let me ask you this. Do you think there are more false prophets or true prophets?
False.
The vast majority of prophets are false prophets. Very few are true prophets of God. And that's because Satan's a deceiver. Verse 2. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit, and notice it doesn't say every man. That's important. It doesn't say every person who says this. He says every spirit who says this. So he's talking about people who are speaking by a spiritual power, not from their own mind. All right? So, every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. Wow. Did you know the spirit of Antichrist, the demonic power behind the man Antichrist, who is probably alive today, but was not alive at the time that John wrote this, there's a spirit. He's not just a man. In the Revelation, it's not just a man, the Antichrist. It is a man, but it's a demon-possessed man. All right? There are demon-possessed people. I mean, we have examples of that in the Gospels, right? The Antichrist is a demon-possessed man. The demon that is going to possess him was already alive, or I shouldn't say alive, because that's kind of a human term. He was already active in the day of the apostles, and he was leading people astray and acting in various ways. In fact, it's the same spirit that's behind Gnosticism and all that stuff. Yes, Jordan.
Is it possible for someone who's been sealed by the Holy Spirit to become demon-possessed? So that's come up to me a couple times.
I don't think that's possible. I don't see how that could possibly be true. I think demons might torment certain people, but I don't see how a person can be demon-possessed if that person is in their body when a Christian receives the Holy Spirit. If the Holy Spirit's in there, he's not sharing it with some demon, I guarantee you that. All right? It's never going to happen. And if a person's demon-possessed, they don't have the Holy Spirit. And if you have the Holy Spirit, you don't have to worry about being demon-possessed. Okay? All right, it's not going to happen. Unless you turn yourself over to it, unless you cause the Spirit of God to leave you because you've completely forsaken him and turn yourself over to something, then it might be possible. But as long as you have the Spirit of God, no, it's not going to happen. All right? Okay. Question. Does John, look at this passage again. He says, every spirit. Does he leave any out? Does he leave out any person speaking in tongues someplace, or any person giving a prophecy? Does he leave that out?
No.
They're all included, right? Everyone. He says, do not, verse 1, do not believe every spirit. That's a commandment. In other words, if we're going to put that in proper language today, what would we say? Do not believe every person or every so-called prophet who prophesies something. Do not believe every person who speaks in tongues that this is from God. Don't believe it. So what's the default position? Don't trust them. Don't trust them. That's number one. Don't trust them. Because why? You have to test every single one. Isn't that what he's saying? You have to test every single one before you accept it. You cannot accept even one prophecy or tongues or whatever it is, anything that's claimed to be by the Spirit of God. You cannot accept it until you test it and until it passes this test. Now what he's saying? Isn't that what he's saying? Why then do Christians, by the thousands, go into crusades and stuff by these guys who are babbling on in all kinds of languages, supposedly languages, or prophesying, or sitting on their TV show and saying, oh, I spoke to God this morning, and he told me blah, 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 blah. And I said, oh, God, but what about this? And God said, oh, no, don't worry about that, Benny. Don't worry about that, because this is what I'm doing over here. And he's quoting God verbatim, right? Question. Should you believe that?
No.
You should never believe it until you test it with this test. Okay? Yes.
Didn't Paul encourage those believers, though, like somewhere in Corinthians 2, speak in tongues in an orderly fashion, not loud, but as long as someone else there can test to like hear, listen to the, I forget what chapter he's in, but does he encourage them just to speak?
He's encouraging them to what?
Speak in tongues in the congregation.
No, he actually discourages it in the congregation. That's in chapter 14, which we're actually going to get to one of these days as part of this series. He actually discourages that, but he does encourage prophesying. But we'll deal with that when we get to that chapter. This is chapter 14. We still have to get through chapter 12 and chapter 13 first on this subject. But the point I want to make is John is very clear that as a Christian, we are not to accept any kind of supernatural speech unless we have tested it with this test and it has passed this test. Now, did he say, just a second, Kathy, did he say that if you read this passage, is he saying, well, then you should go up to the person and say, excuse me, you just made a prophecy. Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ? That Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. Do you believe that? Is that what he said to do?
No.
What did he say? Why didn't he say to do that? You tell me what. Or whoever answered, I didn't hear who did. What did he say? He said it's the Spirit that's confessing it. He didn't say that the person is confessing it. Did you see that? Isn't that what it says? Go ahead. If they don't say, they didn't pass the test. If it's not part of their prophecy, they did not pass the test. If they do not confess in some way that Jesus is the Christ, that he has come in the flesh, as part of their prophecy, while they're speaking by a supernatural power, then they are not of God. They're speaking by the spirit of Antichrist. All right? That's what he said.
Even if you don't ask them, they have to say.
You don't ask, you're not going to have a conversation with the Spirit. All right? The Spirit is coming over somebody and they're just blurting out whatever that Spirit said. All right? You're not going to have a conversation with them.
So that's how you test.
You're listening to what they said and then you're analyzing what they said. And you're looking for a statement that confesses, and it may not be these exact words, but it will mean essentially that Jesus or the Christ has come in the flesh. Now, why that statement? What does that statement mean? So you have to understand the context of what was going on. This was a statement. John was actually drawing a line in the sand against Gnosticism. Gnosticism taught that Jesus and the Christ are two different persons. Jesus is a man, and the Christ is some spirit that just kind of came over him. But what John teaches in opposition to that is that God became flesh. See, there's a difference between a God being taken over a human body, a human person. There's a difference between that and God becoming a man. It's totally different. Isn't that right? You guys get the difference. Gnosticism taught that this divine being called Christ simply came upon a man called Jesus and that they're actually two persons living in one body. That's what Gnostics taught. But the true gospel said that the Christ became flesh and that Jesus is that person. You guys get that difference? It may seem subtle to you, but it's not subtle. And in this context, it wasn't subtle at all. It was a difference between day and night. All right. These Gnostic, it's important that we understand these Gnostic ideas that were so common that the early church battled against. It's important that we understand them so we can spot the counterfeits. Because the counterfeits are bold. The counterfeits are, in fact, the deception is going to be so strong that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24 that they're even going to try to deceive the very elect. The very elect. They're going to try to deceive them. The demons are in these false prophets. So, yeah, go ahead, Stephen. Yes.
Meaning that at the moment that John wrote this, Christ was in the flesh.
Yes.
And really the essence is about the resurrection of Christ.
Yes. And his state now even.
That's right.
Yeah. Let me rephrase that for the people online, because it's actually an important point that I should not have left out. Thank you for that. The word has come is a verb in the perfect tense, as Stephen said. What does perfect tense mean in Greek? It means, it points to an event that has happened in the past, but it's not just an event that happened in the past. It requires that whatever that event was, that the result of that continues to the present. Let me give you a good example of that, okay? I could say, my house burned down. Now, if I used the normal, just the basic past tense, which would be aorist tense, if I use that in Greek, that means at some time in the past, something happened. What happened? My house burned down. Now, I could have rebuilt my house, and I could be living there now. It wouldn't matter, because it doesn't say anything, that tense doesn't say anything about the condition of my house now. All right? It just says it happened. But if I use the perfect tense, it requires that whatever that was, which it, in this case burned down, that result, that state now still exists, even now when I say it. So if I want to say my house burned down and it's still a pile of ashes, I wouldn't use the aorist tense in Greek, I would use the perfect tense. You guys understand that? It's a simple concept. All right, so in English, you would say my house has burned down. But that even that is not as emphatic as it is in the Greek. In the Greek, it means not only did it happen, but the state, that state still exists. Do you guys get that? It's kind of a combination of past tense and present tense. It's a combination of the two. Yes, Jordan.
In English, you would have to say, my house having burned down still sits there.
English, there is no way in English to say it that has the force of the Greek without actually adding a lot of extra verbiage that has all the force of the Greek. But anyway, what's the point then? All right, well, let's look at this passage again, verse 2. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come, that's that perfect tense verb, in the flesh is of God. So what he's saying is he's talking about an event in history. Jesus Christ came in the flesh, right? Now, because he uses the perfect tense, it means Jesus Christ still is in that condition of having come in the flesh. Does that make sense? All right, so what does that mean? It means Jesus Christ, when John wrote this, and he wrote this, probably five decades after Jesus rose again and ascended to heaven, where Acts tells us that, you know, he's seated at the right hand of the Father, you know, and Hebrews says he's waiting for his enemies to be made his footstool, all that kind of stuff, right? He is in the flesh, that he's in the same condition that occurred when he became flesh, when God became flesh, as John talks about. So, let me ask you this. There are lots of Christians who teach that, we're all going to fly away to heaven and we're going to get rid of this body and have a new body and all this other kind of stuff. And these are amillennialists. And many of them also say that Jesus, when he ascended to heaven, yes, he did come out of the tomb and he was a physical person, but when he ascended to heaven, he got rid of that earthly body because, you know, that's not needed in heaven. And so now, you know, he's in a different form now. Is that acknowledging that Jesus Christ has come, perfect tense, in the flesh? No, it's not. In fact, if you look at Acts chapter 2, Peter's sermon, when he's preaching, he talks about David. In fact, you know, I want to look at that. I want you to see this. It's very important to this topic. Acts chapter 2, because it's part of the test of what is of the Spirit of God and what is of the spirit of Antichrist. Peter talks about Jesus in verse 22. He calls Jesus a man. I want you to see this. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man, attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know. Him, that is this man, who is Jesus of Nazareth, him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death, whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be held by it. And why couldn't death continue to hold on to Jesus? He goes on in the next verse. David, excuse me. For David says concerning him, quote, I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart rejoiced and my tongue was glad. Moreover, my flesh also will rest in hope, for you will not leave my soul in Hades or the grave. What is the soul, by the way? A living person, right? A person. Nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life. You have made me full of joy in your presence. That's the end of the quote from David. Then he says, men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn an oath to him, that of the fruit of his body, and note this, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne. He, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus, that is, this Jesus according to the flesh of David, the offspring of David according to the flesh, the one who is going to sit on the throne in the flesh, is what he's saying. This Jesus God raised up, of which we are all witnesses. Notice that in verse 30. He's talking about what David knew when he made the prophecy. See, if you read the prophecy, it sounds like David's talking about himself. Doesn't it? You will not leave my soul in Hades, nor will you allow my flesh to see corruption. Doesn't David writing that, doesn't it sound like David is talking about himself? And what does Peter say? He was not talking about himself because he was a prophet. And not only that, God had made a covenant with David that he would have a son from his own body, from his own, actually he used the word womb in the prophecy. A son will be born from your womb, David. Womb is something a woman has. And what he's saying is through a descendant of yours who's a female, which is Mary, we know. And he will sit upon your throne and reign over Israel forever. Gabriel said this to Mary as well when he appeared to her. So what is he saying? That little phrase, according to the flesh, where was that? Verse 30. Therefore, being a prophet and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that, notice this, what did God swear to him? That of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne. What does that mean? It means when Christ returns and sits on the throne of David to reign over the earth, he is going to do it in the flesh. And it's not only his flesh, it's the flesh that descended from David. Is that human flesh?
Yes,
otherwise it's not flesh that descended from David. Otherwise the covenant God made with David would fail. Unless Jesus Christ, when he comes back to reign, is in the flesh and sits on the throne in the flesh, then God's promise to David has failed. Isn't that right? According to these passages. Now, what do the Gnostics teach? Oh, flesh is evil. Right? Physical substance is evil. Therefore, our goal is to escape the body and to ascend into the heavens as a ghost. That was their hope. Because flesh is evil. Therefore, death is good. Resurrection is bad. Death is release from this prison of the body. Resurrection is further entrapment in physical matter, which is bad. Ascending to heaven is good because we get away from the physical creation. The restoration of the creation and ruling and reigning with Christ in this creation is bad because physical substance is bad. It's the cause of evil. See, that's Gnostic thinking. And the problem that the early Christians had to face and deal with was all these Gnostic ideas that were coming into the church. Paul had to deal with it in 1 Corinthians when the Corinthians were denying the whole idea of resurrection. Why? Because they were right next door to Athens where all this Greek philosophy was, right? That it had invaded. It was already starting to creep into the church there. And John had to deal with it. In all three epistles of John, he deals with these concepts. And so what he does is he in 1 John chapter 4, he draws a line in the sand. He says, look, and not only that, remember, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 12, these guys were used to hearing from demons, and now they're seeing God manifesting through spiritual gifts as well, speaking. And they're comparing these two things because there's a lot of false prophets out there, John says. So how are they going to test them? It's this basic concept between what the Gnostic concept, which comes from Greek philosophy, that basic concept that matter is bad, that spirit is good, and all this kind of stuff. And that worked its way out in the person of Christ as, well, Jesus can't be, the Christ can't be a physical person because that would make him bad because it's physical substance. So they found ways to separate the man Jesus from the Christ who is a divine spirit. They found ways to separate them. Right? Various ways to separate it. One was, well, the Christ spirit was the dove that came upon Jesus at his baptism. Jesus was just a man, and then he left him at the cross. All that. They had all kinds of mythologies, or other Gnostic ideas were that Jesus only appeared to be human. He wasn't actually physically human. He was more like a phantom, that it was meant to, you know, just kind of make people think he was human, but he wasn't really human. And so we had all these concepts going around in the early church. John draws a line in the sand. He says, look, all that stuff is not coming from the Spirit of God. It's coming from the spirit of Antichrist. All right? And so he gave the early church this test. When these spirits are speaking, he wants them to look for these kinds of things. Anything that's teaching this Gnostic kind of Christ is not of God, it's of the spirit of Antichrist. Those who are teaching the idea that the Christ became fully human, that he was flesh and blood, like you and I are, this is from the Spirit of God. That's what he taught. That was the test. And it was because these two ideas that are opposed to each other, one was coming from the Spirit of God and one was coming from the Spirit of Antichrist. All right, and you got to be very careful. And what the devil has done down through the centuries is he has taken some of the ideas from this and he has sort of intertwine them into Christianity here and there, and we have a mess today. Go ahead, Spence. I'm sorry to cut you off there. Yes. Yeah, I'll tell you why I think that's the case. Because the deception in the last days and the Antichrist himself is going to be a revival of Gnosticism. The religion of the beast is a revival of Gnosticism. And what Satan has done is he has so infiltrated the Christian church with Gnostic ideas that it will make it fairly easy when the Antichrist does come for them to take that final step into that final apostasy. All right, to go all the way and end up worshiping Satan instead of worshiping God, which is ultimately what he's after. Yes, Joel.
There's already a book out called the New Testament that incorporates 10 Gnostic gospel books along with it. And they're trying to pass it off as a more modern way of reading the Bible. And some of the others are horrific, the things that happen.
And all that Gnostic idea does is it turns everything upside down. It ends up making Satan good and God evil in the end. And therefore, Satan is to be worshipped. He's very crafty, very deceptive. Go ahead, Stephen. You have one more comment, and then we got to close.
In Revelation 19, John is being given a vision of the marriage supper of the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so overwhelmed, he falls down to worship the angel who is showing him this vision. And an angel backs off and says, "Don't do that. I'm your fellow servant."
Yeah.
And then he ends the 19:10. At the end of that verse, he says, "For the testimony of Jesus Christ is the spirit of prophecy."
Yes.
And I believe that what we're seeing from this, and I think it agrees with what you're telling us today, is that if someone is claiming to be speaking supernatural, the very essence of the message has got to be that Christ has resurrected, he is in the flesh, and he is coming to claim his inheritance.
In the flesh.
Anything other than that, it is anything.
Or if it doesn't include that, let's put it that way. If it doesn't include that, then it's not from God, and you are to reject it. All right, so what God has done here is he's given us an absolutely bulletproof test so that we will not be deceived, particularly, it was applicable to them in the early church because Gnosticism was popular then. But it's going to be applicable to us even more in the last days. Don't believe any prophecy unless it's been tested according to this rule, and it has passed the test. Now, the Bible tells us that there is more true prophecy coming. Isn't that right? In the book of Revelation, there's two prophets who are coming in the last days, and they are going to prophesy. And it tells us how to recognize them as well, and where they're going to be, what they're going to do, all that kind of stuff. It's in the book of Revelation. Read it in chapter 11 of Revelation. All right? So it's not that there's no more prophecy. It's that after God had concluded what he did through the apostles, then the very last apostle told us about the new prophets who are going to come in the last days. And that very same guy who wrote Revelation and told us about those two witnesses also wrote this passage here telling us how to test all these other false prophets to see if they're from God so that we don't get caught up in the deception. It's very, very crafty. And the deception, the groundwork for the deception of the last days was laid a long time ago. And Satan has been weaving it into Christian theology for a long time, for many, many centuries. He's been weaving it in and trying his best to get Christians to adopt it little by little in small increments until it has so corrupted our thinking that getting us to make the final step is not all that hard. It's not all that hard. We've been warned, right? When you start messing with the supernatural, we have a test. Use it or lose it.